Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, covering Central California from Merced to Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, our coverage of the 2016 election ramps up by looking at another popular local race, the one to be Fresno's next mayor. We'll talk with candidate H. Spees in just a bit. Right now, though, we'll look at another election issue, one that affects all of the state, and that's voter turnout. Many Valley counties rank near the bottom when it comes to the turnout of eligible voters. Part of the problem is getting young Latinos interested in voting. As part of our California Counts election series, KQED's Sasha Coca has the story of one family in the city of Lindsay.
Luis Medellin grew up in this rural town of 12,000 people, and the soundtrack of his childhood was shaped by the orange and lemon harvest. The clink of farm workers climbing up tall ladders in the orchards to pick the fruit. Giant wind machines farmers used to warm up the citrus trees on freezing nights. And the rumble of trucks hauling loads of fresh fruit to one of Lindsay's many packing houses.
Streets are all battered because of the trucks, that, heavy trucks that come by, you know, with oranges. When I was little, I'd stand on the sidewalk and, you know, hopefully they'd honk.
As Luis Medellin drives me around town, he points to the spectacular view of lush green foothills and the snow-covered Sierra.
Sure, it's beautiful on the front, but the backside, there's people that go home late at night because they have to pay bills, or kids go to schools next to orange fields any given day when they're spraying pesticides.
Luis Medellin's now in his 20s, but he became a community activist when he was a teenager. He lobbied to improve air quality and drinking water for people in Lindsay, which is 85% Latino. He helped push Tulare County to enact buffer zones around schools that limit when farmers can spray pesticides nearby. So he is making change in his community, but he can't vote. He's undocumented. His three younger sisters were born in the U.S. Amy's the oldest. She's 18. We meet up over a dinner of Hamburger Helper in their kitchen.
Hi, daughter. How's work? Like a heavy chair.
Hi, Ugly. How's it going? We're a really open family. I mean, you can joke and do occasional back of the head slap.
But when we sit down to eat, Luis wants to talk about something serious.
The way I feel is that in my household, Amy is our family's voice, because myself, I don't have legal status. My parents don't have a legal status. And I don't want to say the word depend on her to, you know, for our vote to count. If it came down to it, I mean, we'd want Amy to vote. I'm pretty sure you're registering to vote, or you are registered to vote, because you turned 18 last year, are you?
Yeah, I did register when I got my California ID. I registered.
Okay. Now, and are you going to vote?
It's because of, I don't know, because...
Do you think like, your felt vote like doesn't I didn't make a, count?
Yeah, like, I feel like sometimes my vote doesn't count, especially because right now the generation is in a point where, like, they don't care. But most of us are not even going to vote because we really don't care.
Amy does care about art. She draws fantasy characters like dragons and aliens. She eventually wants to leave this farm town and go to Hollywood to work on special effects. Now she's studying fine art at community college. She's the first in her family to go to college, and she could be the first to vote, but she's not sure.
We're not really well informed in some of the laws or what's going down.
So the issues is what gets you guys.
Yeah.
The issues of who's running or what measures or things like that, that's what confuses this generation. But yet, I mean, there's so much information. I think it's just not to be lazy. The information is there. Read it. What would you do to change that? I mean, to change your generation's train of thought.
That's a question that Lindsay's first Latina mayor, Ramona Villarreal Padilla, wants to ask all the young eligible voters in her town. less than 950 people here voted in the 2014 city council race.
I won maybe by 50 votes. We really need to have the young people go out there and vote. If you think about it and you decide that you don't want to, then lots of other people are going to be making choices for you.
In Lindsay's case, that means a minority of residents deciding for the majority in this city of 12,000 people. We'll return to Lindsay over the coming months to hear more from Mayor Badia and others in this farming town about what makes them care or not care when it comes to voting. I'm Sasha Coca in Lindsay.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we kick off our coverage of the race to be Fresno's next mayor. Over the next few weeks, we'll talk to all of the candidates and try to bring you some insight into who they are and their vision for Fresno. Since the city adopted the strong mayor form of government in the mid-90s, all of the people who have held that office have been conservatives who have held strong support from the local evangelical community. From Jim Patterson to Alan Autry to Ashley Swearingen. Our next guest hopes to continue that streak with a win in November. H. Spees is a pastor and community activist. He's led congregations at both Northwest Church and First Presbyterian. He's also been active in engaging faith-based groups in solving community problems and in the nonprofit sector. He's currently the senior vice president for network growth and development with the group Leadership Foundations and teaches at Fresno Pacific University. H., welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
First off, let's start with the news that came out last night. Our friends at ABC 30 commissioned their first poll of the mayor's race.
Saved me a lot of money.
And released their results. It shows Henry R. Pereira in the lead with 42%, Lee Brand at 23%, and you in third at 15% with 20% of voters still undecided. It's very early in the race.
I got them just where I want them.
What was your initial reaction when you heard the results?
Well, I actually anticipated that I would have a lower percentage. This is a race that includes two incumbents, and they are not me. So I'm an outsider. Ashley Swearingen, when she ran for the race the first time, had about 3% name recognition at this time. So for it to come in at 15% and growing is exciting to us. We think that we are right where we need to be.
So why choose politics now? You're well known, maybe not amongst voters, but among people who have worked in nonprofit groups, faith-based groups, and things like that in the community. Why this change into the political sphere now?
Right. It's trite to say I'm not a politician, but the reality is that the mayor of Fresno is a community leader. When you look at the charter, the way that the charter was written, the mayor of Fresno is to champion causes in Fresno that will make the city better, that will make the community better, that will make the valley better. And I've been doing that with incredible leaders for the last 30 years in Fresno. And so I look at this move as a move to a key leverage point that being mayor of Fresno, we can leverage the resources of the city with the other resources in the city to have some breakthrough results. And as a father of six and a grandfather of 10, soon to be 11, I want my kids and grandkids to choose to live here. But to do that, to make that happen, things are going to have to change.
You could have chosen any city in the U.S. to settle. You chose Fresno. You aren't originally from here. And not only did you choose Fresno, you chose to stay here when I'm sure you had opportunities to go elsewhere. Very accomplished in your educational background and things like that. Why Fresno and why stay here?
Thank you, Joe. This is a funny thing, but I grew up in L.A. And when I was 19 years old, the Martin Luther King for the central area of Mississippi, a man by the name of John Perkins, African-American man who's now 87 years old, spoke to a group of us. I was attending USC at the time. And the call was compelling to go to Mississippi for a summer. That summer stretched into 11 years, rebuilding after the Civil Rights Movement and building communities from a perspective, not from a government perspective, but from the inside out, engaging people on the ground who cared about their communities, black and white, And in doing that, the last 6 years, I was setting up health centers for towns that didn't have doctors. And I was actually invited to Fresno by a couple of doctors who wanted to do something in the community. And so I came as a consultant. And while I was here, I just sensed something very special about Fresno, that people worked together here, that people had a vision and a love for their city, and that there were some incredible leaders. And, you know, having dealt with the black-white divide, also saw huge demographic issues emerging here, a huge Latino population that was contributing to the whole issue of agriculture, a huge influx of Hmong and Lao and Cambodian folks. So when it came time for us as a family to come back home, both Terry and I had this deep sense that Fresno was it, that we needed to come here. So even before I had a job, we had committed to move here. I ended up being a senior health administrator with the Fresno County Department of Health, which jumped me into all of those issues. One of the great projects that we had a chance to work on was a refugee health volunteer project, which connected all these new Americans to the healthcare system. So haven't looked back. We love Fresno. Fresno is a spectacular place to live, and it has some challenges. So let's deal with the challenges and make our city better.
A lot of candidates, a lot of people in office have talked a lot about bringing back to life older parts of town. They can talk a good game. You've actually got skin in the game. You actually are practicing, in essence, what others preach.
Yeah.
Tell me about your decision to move into one of Fresno's roughest neighborhoods back in the 90s.
In 93, I was leading a youth service organization, Youth for Christ. We had moved it into a juvenile hall ministry and working with gang prevention, teen moms, all the issues. We broadened it out from being just a suburban outreach and leadership development program, which it continued to be, to hitting all these other issues. And when you work with at-risk kids in a city, any city, that takes you to the heart of the systemic and structural issues in that city. And I began, Joe, to wake up in the middle of the night, and because I was gripped with kids killing kids in our city. We had 128 gangs, 13,000 car thefts, about 100 homicides. The city was losing its soul. And my wife asked me one time when we were on vacation for a short weekend, she said, "I know something's rattling around in you like a marble in a jar. You might as well tell me what it is." And I said, "I think we're supposed to move downtown." So we moved actually from the lowest crime community in Clovis, the one with the fewest calls for service, into the highest crime, lowest income neighborhood in Fresno. And we're so glad we did, because we aren't the Great White Hopes. We aren't missionaries there. We're there for a purpose. It has helped me to see the city differently. It's gotten me out of my blinders as a suburban Fresnan and helped me to see how Fresno is connected. And so we've had 40 other families move in. We've had a tremendous amount of transformation take place. Ironically, I find myself now thinking, this is not just about my downtown neighborhood. This is about every neighborhood in Fresno. Fresno's a mosaic of 90 elementary school neighborhoods. Every single one is important.
H. Spees is with us today on Valley Edition. He is a candidate for mayor of Fresno. You could have very well run for mayor years ago in 2004, that election, 2003 into 2004. Your good friend Alan Autry had announced that he did not want to run for reelection, that he wanted you to be his successor. And then you wound up taking another opportunity to be pastor at Northwest Church. Do you ever think about what might have been if you had
No, I don't. And for this reason, I mean, first of all, when Alan broke that news to me that I was his chosen candidate, about knocked me off the chair, and I tried to leave his office, and he sort of said, wait a minute, don't, sit down, let's talk. And that was a window of about 3 weeks, and I considered it, I thought about it, I was moving in that direction, and I declared. But a strange set of circumstances took place. And one of them was that a church that I was very close to, a major church in town that had invested tons of money and volunteer hours in the city, Northwest Church, found itself in trauma. They had lost two pastors within 2 years. One was their founding pastor and a key leader in that church. And then ultimately the whole leadership group came to me and said, would you consider taking our church at this time of trauma and dropping out of the mayor's race? So I prayed about it, thought about it, really went through some struggles to make that decision, but just felt like that was what I needed to do. And I did it, and I didn't turn back. And I thought that Alan was – I also had this growing sense that Alan wasn't done, that his second term would be significant. So I have no regrets. And this is very different. This is a different time. Nobody asked me to do this. I just felt a couple of years ago I started feeling this growing desire to serve my city. So that's – I'm in.
Fresno is the fifth largest city in the state. It has a budget in excess of $1 billion. On top of that administrative challenge there, you have to deal with a city council, the politics game there, and trying to use leverage and relationships to get things accomplished. You also have public employee unions, negotiations there. These are things that you don't necessarily deal with on a day-to-day basis and what you've done before. You do have experience in the nonprofit world. Why do you think your background makes you and has prepared you to be Mayor of Fresno?
There are many different types of nonprofits, and most of them are dealing with key issues in one particular rifle shot area. I've had the privilege since working in, you know, from my days in Mississippi when we were doing comprehensive community development, to be involved in comprehensive community development here in Fresno. So for the last 30 years, I've been working to build projects and to attack issues that are key to the thriving of our city. And that has required working with law enforcement and business leaders and education and electeds and the faith-based community and nonprofits, pulling those resources together. I think that the key, Joe, to especially in an area that's resource challenged like Fresno can be, the key is developing, forging public-private partnerships that actually get results on the ground, whether that's related to getting kids reading at grade level by the third grade or whether that's getting kids out of gangs and into productive lives, or whether that's reducing crime in high-density apartment complexes. These are that, – that's what I do. So I've been working with in this area for years. And having the opportunity to be mayor, I think we'll be able to convene many more of those unique partnerships that have made Fresno progress in the past and that will help us in the future.
You mentioned those public-private partnerships. One of them was One by One Leadership, which you were heavily involved with. They had a lot of different revitalization projects
Yes.
in downtown. Around 2009, though, things started going south with that organization.
Actually a little bit earlier. Yeah, when the recession hit, when I had led One by One Leadership up until 2003 when I joined Northwest Church. I've been gone for about 4 years. And One by One, over a period of 7 to 10 years, had channeled millions of dollars into Fresno, into some great projects. I was asked to rejoin the board, did that, tried to save it, realized I looked at the balance sheets and the financials and especially the land that that One by One, under my leadership, had purchased two blocks of homes. Some of which were completely blighted and some were historic. And the goal was to make that a center for faith-based civic renewal and just civic renewal in general. Anyway, long story short, the recession hit. They found themselves over-leveraged in terms of land. We sorted that out. I actually made the recommendation of the board to shut it down. We outsourced the programs, many of which are still going on today, paid all the debts, did not go through bankruptcy. But then we really anchored down on that land, and that land is between San Joaquin and Divisadero on L Street. So it really was a blight on the downtown neighborhood. But we were able to turn that around. And you talk about partnerships. All of our dreams have come true. If you stand at the corner of San Joaquin and L, you'll see beautiful housing. You'll see incredibly restored historic homes, but it took the Housing Authority, it took Darius Assimi and Granville Homes, it took a private investor from outside, it took a big church that was willing to renovate a historic home. It took multiple partners to make that happen. That's what I do. It took a lot of time, it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. We got it done, and we're proud of it.
Let's move on to some of the issues that are in front of voters right now. Crime is obviously something that is always a concern to Fresno voters. It seems right now, though, maybe even a little more of a concern than in recent years. Chief Dyer has talked about an uptick in certain crimes in the community, and this remains a problem. Every candidate says they want to be tough on crime. They want to do more to stop this. What are you able to do? Because as mayor of Fresno, you don't control the Fresno County Jail. There's only so much in that pot of funds that you have to hire cops.
Right.
How do you try to use the resources you already have more effectively and try to save neighborhoods?
Well, there is an uptick in crime. In fact, it's feeling a little bit like the early 90s, and we need to stay ahead of this curve. When Ashley Swearingen, our mayor, deftly led our city through and around the shoals of financial disaster in the recession and saved us from bankruptcy, and we're grateful for that. Part of what took place, though, was that our law enforcement, our cops were cut from 850 down to 691, and we have made some gains, but not quickly enough. So what has to happen is we need to add more police officers. Not only that, but we need to compensate them at a higher level. And the reason for that is that we are losing some of our veteran police officers to other departments that pay similar and require much less. So those two things have to happen. But to, in terms of leadership, Joe, and getting ahead of the curve on crime, this is not just about a line item. This is, first of all, it's about cops. Cops are people. And I've talked to many of our police officers, and they are facing some severe challenges. I mean, they are – because the numbers are down, they're having difficulty getting time off. I mean, stress is going up. There was a recent report that Jerry Dyer commissioned that looked at morale. And it's difficult. He's looking that square in the eye, and it's difficult. So what needs to happen is not only do we need more and better compensation, but we also need to intercept the future rather than have the future roll over us. And to me, that means community policing. That means looking at broken windows theory. That means not just staffing up to what we were in 2008. It means how do we deploy our department in order to be more connected with the community. And my conviction is that community policing, where every neighborhood, every one of those 90 elementary school neighborhoods in the mosaic of Fresno deserves its own cop. Every neighbor deserves to be able to know the name of their cop. And why is that so important? In an age of Ferguson, of school shootings, of terrorism, the only way for us to really stay ahead of the curve is to really focus on the connection between the community and police department, and that's community policing. The more those connections are made and affirmed, the more crimes will be prevented, the more efficient the police department will be because of tips and what have you, but also the more trust. And this is a key time in our history for community trust. We've got a very trustworthy police department. We need to maintain and build that trust for the future.
Community activist and pastor H. Spees is our guest today on Valley Edition. He's a candidate to be the next mayor of Fresno. I think one of the most consequential things that Mayor Swearingen has done in the city, and certainly her most recent years, is her approach to homelessness. The city closed down several large downtown homeless encampments. The homeless people went and dispersed throughout much of the rest of the city. The city says that homelessness is down significantly. I talked to many people who maybe question the accuracy of those counts. There's a lot of different views on homelessness. Do you continue this policy right now if you were mayor of Fresno? Would you advocate an approach that is a more more stringent, as some would say, criminalizing homelessness. How do you approach the homelessness issue?
Criminals are criminalizing homelessness. That's a key issue. I was just with a multi-agency group yesterday that is doing a pretty fabulous job in getting their arms around this. But the fact is that you've got kind of a tsunami of social issues that are resulting in a challenge on the streets of our city that is going under the broad banner of homelessness. And that's really inaccurate. When you've got Prop 47, when you've got prison realignment, and those – and basically what the state is doing is pushing prisoners, ex-offenders back to our community. And then you add that to the whole all the issues of homelessness. That is a tsunami. That's a major issue. Bottom line is that nobody should have to live or die on the streets of our city. So it requires compassion. It requires tenderness. On the other hand, no grandmother or mother taking their three grandkids or kids to Taco Bell deserves to be accosted by an aggressive panhandler. That's wrong too. And so that requires toughness. And those criminals that have embedded themselves in the homeless population that are doing crimes need to be routed out. So to deal with this, Joe, you have to have a tough and tender policy. So I will ramp up the enforcement of panhandling ordinances and shopping cart ordinances that are on our books. The Fresno County Grand Jury has documented that. But in addition to that, I'm going to continue to pursue the mayor's strategy and the strategy of a network, a continuum of care of homelessness that's really getting traction. And that is they're developing MAP points, multi-agency service points. They've started one at Poverello House. They plan to put others at hospitals and at key areas where folks can have access and get people the mental health services, the substance abuse recovery services, the VA PTSD counseling services that they need, and untangle the web of homelessness for one individual at a time. It has to be name by name, person by person. It has to be a rigorous approach. I've worked with groups in Southern California and various parts of the country that have had great success. We can bring those best practices here as well. But it's a major part, major plank in my platform to have a tough and tender policy as it relates to homelessness.
Around 15, 16 years ago, your friend Alan Autry started talking about a tale of two cities and this north-south divide in Fresno. And certainly it existed before that, but I think Alan was maybe the first person to talk about it from the mayor's office in that sort of a way. Mayor Swearingen has continued talking about it and really invested a lot of time and resources in trying to focus not on just on downtown, but on neighborhoods south of Shaw. There's also a challenge in maintaining that sort of momentum, is that many people in the rest of the city, maybe many people who might even be your voters in North Fresno might say, you know, why all this focus on this? I have problems in my neighborhood. You also believe in this divide and the importance of trying to bring equity to older parts of town. How do you maintain that focus, and how do you manage to navigate that course?
I think you have to do it by I'm grateful for Alan's prophetic statement about the Tale of Two Cities. And I've been very encouraged by Ashley's commitment to embrace that, but not only to embrace it, but to structure some initiatives that have really made a difference in terms of the general plan and beginning to think about rebuilding core neighborhoods in a structural way. The new development code, that the development code hadn't been looked at for 60 years. These are things that move the hash marks that are game changers. My approach is that there are many Fresnos, and every Fresno is important. Every Fresno, one Fresno, and putting Fresno first. And so I'm in an ironic spot where although I've been focused in one neighborhood for 22 years, I've worked with people throughout the city on major urban issues. And I find myself saying that every neighborhood is important. The woman who gets her FedEx package stolen off of her porch at Woodward Lakes has just as much an issue and a right to services and protection and security as the family that's concerned about a drive-by that took place across the street in southeast Fresno. Every neighborhood is important. When you stand in front of Bulldog Stadium and you look to the east, you see one of the most significant economic engines in Fresno, the university itself, Fresno State. You look to the right, and there's El Dorado Park. This is in northeast Fresno. El Dorado Park is a very challenged neighborhood. Now, they made huge strides, and there are great people working in that neighborhood. Joe, it's going to take every single neighborhood. It's one Fresno. And championing the one Fresno, I think people get that. They understand that we're connected. They understand that you can't just turn your back on blight and neighborhood decay in the south and expect that that isn't going to have consequences in the north. People, smart people, understand that connection. But we have to value every single neighborhood.
Pastor and community activist H. Spees is a candidate to be Fresno's next mayor. The election's coming up in June. H., thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Valley Edition and learn how a change that begins today with the state of California could affect parents who take their kids to local development centers to get autism care. That's coming up later on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Valley families who rely on local developmental centers to get therapy for their autistic kids could be in for a change. Starting today, the state of California is changing the way it manages that program through Medi-Cal, and it has some parents concerned. According to some, about one half of the providers who currently work with autistic children at the state developmental centers may no longer see those patients. Here to tell us more is journalist David Gorn with California Healthline. David, welcome.
Hi there.
Exactly what sorts of services and providers are we talking about here?
So there's about 9,000 kids total in the state with autism being seen at these 21 regional centers, and there's two in the Central Valley. One's in Bakersfield, one's in Fresno. Those kids today are starting to move into Medi-Cal managed care, and that doesn't mean they're actually physically going anywhere. They're still getting care at the regional centers, but the financing of how they get that care is changing. The trouble is that there are new rules. To be in Medi-Cal managed care, there are certain providers who are accepted and then certain providers who are excluded. So about half of those providers who are currently working at those regional centers will be excluded.
Why would they be excluded?
Well, so it's a little complicated, but the simple answer is that the managed care plan, so the state contracts with managed care plans now, those managed care plans, a few of them would prefer the rule to exclude some of those providers. It's just sort of the way they have done business. It's what they've set up. Most, a good number of them don't want to exclude anyone. And so the state sort of erred on the side of caution, and in their rules, they excluded people who got their credential a long time ago. So people who have worked 20, 30 years, it's not really an exclusion of ability or experience. In fact, they're actually more experienced, the ones who are being excluded generally. So the children's advocates, they say that it's kind of random, that they feel that it's a change that doesn't really need to be made, and it could affect a lot of kids.
And as you said, it affects the developmental centers both in Fresno and Bakersfield. What sorts of care are we talking about?
Well, so kids with autism, they need sort of intensive behavioral therapy. So if you think about an autistic kid, maybe one behavior they have is they run around in circles and make a lot of noise and have a lot of energy, right? And so you want to, like, get them to sit at a table and do half an hour of studying. So to do that, you have to do it incrementally. Like, you have to, like, so first you get them to sit at the table with their hands folded for 10 seconds, and then you get them to do it for 20 seconds, and then you get them to do it for a minute and 2 minutes, and then you get them to do a task for, you know, 30 seconds, and so on, right? So the kids with autism are kind of behind. The simplistic way to think of it is that they sort of just need to, their brain runs in a different direction. It needs to be rewired, sort of. And so that's very simplistic. But the idea is that you go through this intensive behavioral therapy to catch up. And then, like, while you're going through that intensive behavioral therapy to catch up, all the other kids that you've caught up to have moved on during that time. So it's like over a long period of time to try and sort of reach that plateau where the other kids are.
So looking at this problem with the access to these providers, maybe this is also simplistic. Why don't those providers who maybe got their certification 20, 30 years ago, why don't they, in order to maintain their eligibility, update that or get the continuing education? Is it that simple, and why is that the sticking point here?
Well, I mean, it's not quite that simple because, for one thing, they actually have sometimes more knowledge, more experience, and more training than the ones with the credentials, because the credentials are just, you know, from the last 15 years, and maybe they got theirs 25, 30 years ago. So, but the problem is that there's a dearth of autism providers. There's not enough autism providers in the state. And so, you know, all the autism providers, they've all built their business around these kids at the regional centers, but if they're being excluded, there's plenty of business elsewhere. They can see other kids. They don't have to see these kids. I mean, they want to see these kids, but the real issue becomes if you're excluding. So let me just say one other thing, which is that the state has said, made it really clear, there's not going to be a kid who transitions, who moves into Medi-Cal managed care, unless there's a provider in place to see them, which is great. However, if you exclude half of those providers, then the question becomes, where are you going to get new ones? Because there are just so few of them.
So what's next? This transition, as I understand, starts today. Is there?
It
sounds like there's some pushback from healthcare advocacy groups and parent groups. What's going to happen? How does this work?
Well, so no one knows exactly what's going to happen. So the state is moving ahead with the transition. So one possible thing that could happen is that managed care plans, the ones who don't want to exclude providers, might just go against sort of the letter of the law and continue to use providers even though they're not sanctioned by the state. So that's one possibility. So the other thing that's going on is that there's a bill being carried by Holly Mitchell that is going to change the language so that those providers aren't excluded. But there's also one problem with that, which is the bill, if it gets approved, if the legislature votes on it, they'll vote in June or July or August. The governor will sign it in September. It'll go into effect January 1st, and by then, this transition is over. And so I guess the thing to remember about these kids with autism is that because it's this intensive behavioral therapy, like, first of all, they don't do very well with change. And so any change in provider or any gap in care is going to really affect these kids. So it really, like, puts them farther and farther behind. So, you know, if the state goes ahead and says, you know, these providers are excluded and you have to get a different provider, it's possible they could see another provider, that would be a problem for them because it would sort of put them behind. But the real question is, in the next month or 2 months, are the kids at these regional centers going to find themselves scrambling to find a provider?
You can read,
and will they have a gap in care? That's the big question.
You can read journalist David Gorin's coverage of this issue in regards to care for autistic kids and other health care news online at californiahealthline.org. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Valley Edition. Beekeepers flock from all over the country to California every February and March for bloom. During this time of year, over 80% of the nation's commercial bees buzz around the central part of the state, pollinating almond trees. But as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, an advancement in almond breeding could decrease the need for those bumbling insects.
That's the sound of honeybees gathering nectar and pollen from almond flowers to feed their colony's young. As bees fly from flower to flower in this almond orchard at Fresno State, their hairy bodies trap pollen, carrying it between trees. Each blossom successfully pollinated in this process will become an almond. In this orchard alone, Madeira beekeeper Brian Hyatt has about 1.5 million bees.
Really, the key is to stay calm around bees, because if you're afraid, then your body physiologically changes, and they can sense that. They really literally can smell fear.
Even though this time of year is really busy for beekeepers, Hyatt is worried that a relatively new variety of almonds called Independence could harm the longevity of his business. This almond variety is supposed to be self-fertile. It needs fewer or no bees to pollinate its flowers. That makes Hyatt uneasy.
I could see us losing money, losing profits. There's a lot of these old almonds that still need bees. That's fine. That's job security for me. But, the Independence is kind of a threat to that security.
But Gene Brandy with the American Beekeeping Federation isn't distressed over the self-fertile variety of almonds. Bees have their own issues, including winter die-off and the colony collapse disorder that's killed as much as 40% of honeybees in the West.
I don't see it as a bad thing at all, because I know how difficult it has been for our industry to supply the bees that are needed. We've got an excessive number of winter losses this year around the nation. I've got friends that have lost 60 or 70% of their beehives.
For farmers like Josh Pitliano from Tulare County, the lack of demand for bees is a win. He has several hundred acres of the self-fertile variety near Tipton. He first planted the trees 6 years ago.
We like the Independence tree. We like the ease of harvest. So this is 10 acres of Independence we have. It's our oldest block of Independence. And I come in here once and I harvest all the nuts all at one time.
Traditional almond orchards have several varieties of the tree planted in each field and are harvested multiple times. With Independence, Pitliano says there's an added benefit. He uses less than half the amount of bees on the crop compared with his other varieties.
When these trees were young, I actually worked with one of my beekeepers, and we actually bee netted some trees when they were smaller. Without the bees working this field, it was a significant reduction in yields.
An average hive of bees costs around $180. Most farmers place two hives per acre, but Pitliano scrapes by with as little as half a hive per acre on his orchards of Independence. He noticed this variety is shorter and more bush-like compared to its bee-needing counterparts. But the almonds are just as good, says 79-year-old Easton grower Ben Barra. He's spraying his 18 acres with a fungicide to prevent disease. When he realized he didn't have to use bees with the Independence variety, he was hooked.
We met the guy that invented them, and he says there's one thing, you don't need bees, and you could just plant them and go. And that's why I done it.
Barra has farmed everything from sugar beets to eggplant to potatoes. He tore out his peaches and plums after he had a really bad season, losing over $100,000. So he latched onto the idea of a crop he'd only have to harvest once and use no bees on. So far, he says the Independence variety has produced more pounds than he originally expected.
You can't believe it. The first year we did 6,000, then we did 17,000. Last year we did 31,000.
This year he hopes the acreage's yield is over 40,000 pounds. But he realizes he's taking a chance on a new nut variety that hasn't stood the test of time.
When I gambled with it, this was the last shot I was making. This is it. If it don't work this time, I'll just stay in the house.
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
For 15 years now, Fresno's Tower District has been the home of one of the largest fringe festivals on the West Coast, or at least what has grown into that. The Rogue Festival begins its 15th run this week in the Tower District and beyond. Here to tell us more about this year's event is producer of The Rogue, Jonathan Hogan. Jonathan, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, let's talk about what a Rogue Festival is all about. You are considered a fringe festival, although that's not in your title of the event. What is the genre of Fringe Festival about before we talk about the Rogue specifically?
Well, Fringe Festivals are kind of experimental theater, art, music. It's not the norm. It's not necessarily mainstream. So it's not your Rodgers and Hammerstein. It's not, you know, Sondheim musicals or Neil Simon plays. It's usually original material. It's usually edgier and always unique.
And your festival is a non-juried festival, meaning that there's no panel of artists who are producers who select the material. What does a producer of a non-juried festival wind up doing then?
It's a lot of herding cats is what it is. It is non-juried, so the beauty is that anybody can get in. Anybody can get in. You have,
and you don't mean just attendees. You mean
people
who are performing.
If you want to do a dance with an artichoke heart and you pay your money, you can be in the festival. That's the beauty of it. The bane of it is also that sometimes you don't know what you're going to get, and there can be some stinkers in the Rogue Festival. I know I've been in a couple of them. So it's always fun though. A true Rogue Festival experience is you'll stumble across something that you won't expect to be good, that it just blows your mind. And then sometimes you run across something that is less successful.
Well, that's the adventure. How many performances are we talking about here?
There are about 75 performers in the festival and 300 or so shows overall in the 9 days of the event.
So there's an opportunity if, for example, someone has a show on one night, I missed it that night, I can go back another occasion in some cases.
Yes. Oh, no. All performers have at least three or more shows. So there are three different opportunities to see, at the very least, three different opportunities to see a specific show through the time.
This is the 15th anniversary of the event. How has the Rogue changed over the years?
In a lot of ways, it hasn't as far as content, but public awareness has changed. The number of people coming has changed. The number of performers that have come has changed. When Marcel Nunes created it in 2002, it was very much a homegrown, local talent kind of event. Over the years, more people have discovered the festival that live out of town, out of the state, out of the country, and we've actually gotten a national and international reputation amongst fringe festival performers. They want to come and do our festival because the town is great, Fresno's great. They love the Fresno audiences. They're very warm, and they get a good response. So it's grown in size, it's grown in scope, but it still is a homegrown festival at heart.
Is that a challenge as it has grown in reputation, maintaining spots for local performers? You want to be non-juried, so you don't want to discriminate on that sense. Oh, you're from Canada, we don't want you here. You don't want to do that, but do you reserve spots for locals? How does that work?
Right now, spots aren't reserved. It's first come, first serve. We do try to encourage local performers specifically and give them a bit of a leg up, get them a little more prepared so that when we go live with applications, they're there, they're on it, and they apply. This year, we sold out of spots within 15 minutes. The first year, if I remember correctly, and I probably won't, but the first year I believe it took 10 days to fill the festival with far fewer slots. Now we have like 70 slots available, and they get filled up in 15 minutes.
We have a few minutes left here. Let's talk move from the performer's side to the attendees side of this. For people who are attending, how does it work? You have multiple venues. Do you have a pass? Do you buy tickets?
Yes is the answer to all that question. We do have multiple venues. You can buy a pass. You can buy tickets at the door. Every venue, whether it's a rogue venue proper or an off-rogue venue, you can buy tickets at the door with cash or credit card. You can go online to roguefestival.com and get links to the ticketing page and buy online tickets in advance. During the festival, starting at the teaser show this Thursday night, which I encourage everyone to come through, you can purchase a 10-show pass that will get you into 10 shows while you're there. The other thing that is a requirement is a Rogue wristband. That's a $3 wristband. It's a one-time purchase, and that is required to get into every show along with a ticket.
You mentioned the off-rogue shows. How does that – what is that about? This is for four-wheel enthusiasts?
It is. Or? It's for four-wheeling. If you go off-roguing. There are six main rogue venues that we manage and produce specifically, and then there are three other venues that manage themselves. They're still rogue venues, but we call them off-rogue, just a little differentiation. They book their own acts. They do their own house and run their own shows, but they're all part of the Rogue Festival.
What does it take to put this on?
A little bit of insanity and a whole lot of organization.
I mean, it's not just you running around and setting up ticket booths and buying wristbands.
I'm a very small part of it. The production team includes Barbara Coy Hogan, who is the executive director of the festival, also Amber Streed, who is a producer along with myself. The three of us spearhead a team of about 20 people that help put the festival on. We're all volunteers. We all put time in because we love the festival. We love doing things like this in Fresno. And we don't do it alone. We don't do it alone.
Jonathan, if people want more information either about the preview show Thursday at the Tower Theater or the actual event venues themselves and the schedule, what should they do?
Go to roguefestival.com. All performer information is on there. Schedules. Tickets can be purchased through the site, links there. You can also pick up a Rogue Festival program. They are at several businesses throughout the Tower District that will also help you find out what you want to do.
And that's Rogue Festival, R-O-G-U-E, festival.com.
That's right.
Again, Jonathan Hogan, producer of this year's festival, the 15th annual event taking place starting this weekend in the Tower District. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us talk@kvpr.org or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.